Good day. Today is Tuesday, 5th May 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Now, in this programme, I'm going to return for as short a time as I can at the beginning to the situation in the Middle East. Yesterday, we had a whole series of events which were basically kick-started by certain comments made by President Trump, which suggested that he had ordered, or is about to order, the United States to break Iranian control of the Strait of Hormuz. A number of events then followed, quickly after each other. Firstly, there were reports that the Iranians had fired at an American warship close to the Strait of Hormuz. There were reports that the Iranians claimed that they'd actually hit this warship. The Pentagon denied that such hits had in fact taken place. And then over the course of the day, there was a resumption of missile and drone strikes, which struck a major energy facility in the United Arab Emirates, which was being used by the Emiratis in order to try to circumvent the closure of the Strait of Hormuz by providing an alternative access point for the export of Emirati oil. And all of this led to much commentary on the internet and in the media yesterday that the ceasefire between the United States and Iran, which has been in existence now for about a month, that the ceasefire was on the brink of collapse. And there were many reports about US refueling tankers converging on the Middle East and about another attack on Iran pending and being about to happen. And, well, there were all sorts of other detailed claims. The US claimed that two US flagged tankers were able to pass through the Strait of Hormuz. The Iranians, by the way, categorically deny this. There were also claims by the United States that they had destroyed several Iranian speedboats of the sort used by the IRGC. The Iranians again denied this. And, well, as I said, there was much commentary and discussion about this, and expectations by many people that by today we would see a full resumption of hostilities between Iran and the United States. Well, as of today, as of the time of making this program, that has not happened. And yesterday, President Trump, whose words must always be taken with great caution, over the course of a, well, I suppose you could call it a news conference, a meeting with the media, downplayed the significance of what was happening, referred it to it all as a mini war, gave the impression that actually there had not been very much of importance taking place yesterday overall. Now, it's never easy to be completely sure, but I have to say that this is the view that I lean towards. About a week ago, might have been a bit longer, around the time when President Trump renewed the US naval blockade of Iran, he made all kinds of predictions that Iran was within 2 weeks of seeing the total implosion of its economy, that the Iranian authorities would run out of money to pay wages, that the economy would collapse, and that at around this point, Iran would be forced to come to terms with the United States. And this was also supplemented by all sorts of commentaries by which appeared in all kinds of places about how the Iranians, because of the ongoing sea blockade, would soon run out of all oil storage capabilities. Well, I was always skeptical about these claims because it seemed to me that in reality, despite the fact that undoubtedly the conflict has reduced the level of exports of Iranian oil, the Iranians nonetheless have been able to continue to export some oil to China, mostly through the Straits of Hormuz, without very much in the way of interference from the US Navy. And besides, as I've discussed in many programs, Iran considers itself to be in a state of war and siege. Countries which find themselves in that kind of situation are in a position to take emergency mobilization measures in relation to their economy, and that can give an economy significant room for maneuver and resilience, which a peacetime economy obviously does not have. And my expectations were that the Iranians would be coming under pressure, economic pressure, more probably by the end of this year, if at all, rather than by the first week or second week of May, as some people were saying. And by the way, and in addition to that, there is growing evidence that the Iranians are indeed getting more and more help from their friends. I read a commentary in an Iranian media outlet about the fact that Iran has now mainly focused its overseas trade through its ports on the Caspian Sea. Well, this is, of course, a little disingenuous because the Caspian Sea, though it is called a sea and is a saltwater body of water, is basically a gigantic inland lake. And, of course, when the Iranians talk about overseas trade through the Caspian Sea, what they really mean is trade with Russia and some of the other Central Asian states, probably mostly Kazakhstan. And yes, no doubt that is taking place. And yes, no doubt that is being ramped up. But anyway, we need to maintain a sense of proportion. But nonetheless, the Iranians do receive a significant amount of trade through the Caspian Sea. And there were reports that Pakistan, which is, of course, a friend of Iran's and a close ally of China, has opened various overland routes across its territory to enable Chinese goods to reach Iran by land. There is, by the way, a fact that is little known to most people, an actual railway that directly connects Iran with China across Pakistani territory. So when you put it all together, it did seem to me that President Trump's expectations of a rapid collapse of the Iranian economy in the face of his sea blockade was, well, from his point of view, optimistic to say the least. I say optimistic, but I would at this point also just register my own astonishment at the speed that commentary in the West, not just in the United States and not just by Donald Trump, but in the West generally, the speed at which commentary in the West has moved from the narrative in January at the time of the protests inside Iran to the need to come to the protesters' rescue in order to save and safeguard the Iranian people, to a position today when we are talking about ramping up sanctions and intensifying an economic blockade on Iran in order to further impoverish the Iranian people, in order to provoke them into protests, which might perhaps lead to the overthrow of the Iranian government. But anyway, I'm not going to dwell on that further in this program. Suffice to say that I thought that the expectations of an Iranian economic collapse in a few weeks were overstated. Obviously, there is a lot of inflation in Iran. There always is, by the way. But I don't think the Iranians are facing the kind of situation economically on their domestic economic front where a collapse is imminent, or where the Iranian government feels itself under any significant pressure to make concessions. There is a very good article about this, by the way, by my friend Ian Proud in Responsible Statecraft. Ian Proud was at the cutting edge of the sanctions war against Russia. He knows more about sanctions, I suspect, than pretty much everyone else who writes, discusses, or comments about this issue. He's spoken consistently correctly about the limited effect of sanctions on Russia, and I found the very interesting things he had to say about economic pressure on Iran, well, equally interesting. Anyway, that's one thing, but I think that one person who perhaps was particularly disappointed by the fact that all this economic pressure on Iran was not achieving the results that he wanted, which first and foremost now are to get the Strait of Hormuz reopened. One particular person was, and undoubtedly still is, the President of the United States, Donald Trump. Because, of course, whilst the ongoing stalemate between the United States and Iran continues, whilst the Strait of Hormuz remains closed, oil prices, energy prices around the world continue to rise. That's having now a significant effect on the domestic economic situation within the United States. The figures show, the polling figures show, President Trump's popularity continuing to fall, and he's very sensitive about that, and he's very sensitive about the long-term situation in the American economy, if only because he knows how high inflation in the United States was the single most important reason for the implosion of the Biden presidency that preceded his own. And, well, if Trump himself isn't thinking about these things, he has all sorts of people, including, I strongly suspect, his chief of staff, Susie Wiles, reminding him of it. So, unsurprisingly, Trump became impatient and he started to put pressure on his military people to get them to open the Strait of Hormuz as soon as possible, because this economic pressure he was placing on Iran was not working in the way that he expected and perhaps was led to believe. And that, it seems to me, provides the background for all of the things that we saw happen yesterday. The announcement that the US Navy would somehow manage to guide ships through the Strait of Hormuz, never explained how that was supposed to happen. The Navy quickly said that they would not escort ships through the Strait of Hormuz, given which any ships trying to transit the Strait of Hormuz would quickly find themselves at risk from the Iranians. There was the Iranian warning shots, and going to the Iranian media, it seemed to me that what the Iranians were saying was not that they'd actually damaged a US warship, but rather that they'd fired warning shots at it, which led it to withdraw. So an awful lot of noise, an awful lot of claims about two merchant ships transiting the Strait of Hormuz, which the Iranians deny, claims about Iranian speedboats being destroyed, which the Iranians deny, an attack by someone against this energy facility in the Emirates, and I will come to that in a moment. But in the end, everything continuing in exactly the way that it was. The Iranians still in control of the Strait of Hormuz. Ships, merchant ships, tankers, still unable and unwilling to risk transiting the Strait of Hormuz. The United States having made all sorts of bold claims about guiding ships through the Strait of Hormuz and attacking Iranian military assets that were obstructing the Strait of Hormuz, but none of this ultimately translating into much by way of actual action, and everything in the end remaining exactly as it was. The Iranians in firm control of the Strait of Hormuz, ships still not passing through, the United States still sporadically enforcing its blockade on Iran, and oil prices continuing to go higher. In effect, a lot of sound and fury signifying nothing. That, in my opinion, is what we saw yesterday. Now, I said a lot of sound and fury, which amounted to nothing, but somebody did attack the Emirates yesterday and did do significant damage to an Emirati energy facility, and that does seem to have caused a lot of dismay and distress in the UAE. Now, the Iranians deny being responsible, and in this part of the world, the possibility that this was some kind of false flag operation by someone, the Emiratis themselves, though I can't quite believe that, the Israelis, perhaps someone else, who knows, I can't quite believe it was the United States. Anyway, the possibility that it was a false flag, this being the Middle East, is not one that can be wholly excluded. But for the record, despite their denials, I think it probably was the Iranians. They have the means to do it, and they have the motive to do it. The Emirates has been, amongst all of the Arab states, the one that has been most hostile to Iran over the entire period since the start of the American operation against Iran on the 28th of February. The Emirates continues to make territorial claims on certain islands in the Strait of Hormuz, which are controlled by Iran. I'm not going to get into a discussion about who is right about that particular dispute because I generally don't know. The Emiratis, as I've discussed in several programs now, have recently pulled out of OPEC and OPEC Plus and are positioning themselves to ramp up exports of oil. And they have also been the first of the Persian Gulf states to conclude a swap arrangement with the US Federal Reserve Board. So, altogether, the Iranians have no reason to like the Emiratis. And they are probably, in fact, they're undoubtedly aware of the Emirati attempts to try to circumvent the closure, the effective closure of the Strait of Hormuz. And it makes complete sense to me that the Iranians would take action against Emirati facilities that aim to bypass the Strait of Hormuz, if only in order to tell the Emiratis, don't for one second imagine that we don't know, and that we are not going to take action to stop you if you persist in doing this. After all, for the Iranians, their hold over the Strait of Hormuz is the single most important leverage they have, and they will not take it well if their enemies, the Emiratis, seek to undermine their position in that respect. So, whilst I don't completely disregard the Iranian denials, it seems to me that the simplest explanation is the best one here, and that it was indeed the Iranians who carried out the attack on the Emirati facilities. Now, I suspect that for the Iranians, this episode is over. The only big question is what the United States is going to do. And yes, there has been that major movement of refueling tankers, air refueling tankers, to the Persian Gulf. We can see that more pieces are being moved by the United States on the board. And some, like, for example, Larry Johnson at Sonar 21, believe that Donald Trump is indeed edging back towards a military confrontation against Iran. All I would say about that is that though with Trump you can never assume anything, I cannot myself see why an attack on Iran is going to make any logical sense. After all, the United States conducted 40 days of missile strikes and airstrikes against Iran and failed to achieve a single political or military objective. Donald Trump has known that the Iranians have exercised tighter control of the Strait of Hormuz throughout that time. The US Navy has been in the area for some time. In fact, the overall number of ships have reduced because the USS Gerald Ford is now steaming back to the United States. If the US Navy was unable to break the Strait of Hormuz whilst the fighting was underway, why does President Trump, why would President Trump believe that the US Navy can break the Iranian control of the Strait of Hormuz now. It doesn't make immediate sense to me. And of course, and not to be ignored, we had that conversation between Putin and Trump, which I have discussed in several places now. It was a conversation over the course of which Putin, who is Iran's major backer, gave Trump a categorical warning against resuming attacks against Iran. I have described it, I have described that warning in various places as a cease and desist demand. And Trump, who is undoubtedly aware of the extent of Russian assistance to Iran and of its likely game-changing implications, I would not have thought would want to get into a head-to-head conflict with an Iran that is currently backed by Russia. Last but not least, there is, of course, the further overriding problem that the United States, as every report says, has massively depleted its arsenal so that it would be going back on the attack from a weaker position than the one it was in on the 28th of February. Donald Trump is an extraordinary man, very volatile, very unpredictable, not always someone who thinks through what he does, quite often tempted to do entirely the wrong thing, and very often going ahead and doing it. But logic, as far as I can see, points rather to Trump wanting to keep the situation stable and calm at the moment, rather than wanting to lurch back to war. At least that is my preliminary assessment. It may be that he might be goaded back onto the attack. We have voices like Senator Lindsey Graham, the single most disastrous figure, in my opinion, in US politics, who's coming along and telling Trump to finish the job. There are others like General Kellogg, who also make similar demands and give equally bad advice. There's also Trump's problem in that he can't find a straightforward solution to this crisis into which he has landed himself in, and he must be worried about the steady upward tick in oil prices and the steady downward tick in his favorability rating. So there's always the chance that something could go very, very badly wrong and that he might decide to go for broke again and ignore the advice of his chief military advisors and restart the military operation against Iran. But my guess is that for the moment at least, that's probably not what he's going to do. Anyway, in the meantime, the Iranians are now following up with Araghchi's previous big diplomatic initiative. His trip to Russia, where he met, of course, in St. Petersburg with Vladimir Putin, Sergei Lavrov, and Admiral Kostyakov, the head of Russian military intelligence. The Iranians have now said that Araghchi is now flying to Beijing, where he's going to meet with Wang Yi, China's foreign minister, and Xi Jinping's national security advisor. And thereafter, it's quite likely that he will also meet with Xi Jinping himself. Notice that all of this is likely to happen at roughly the same time when President Trump himself is supposed to be traveling to China. Anyway, we shall see what happens. We shall see what the discussions are. The Chinese, up to now, have shown a certain preference for a diplomatic resolution, and it was they who pressured the Iranians against their better judgment to agree to a ceasefire. But perhaps the change of policy by China on observance of US sanctions that I've discussed both in a video and in other places, perhaps that does indeed suggest, as the Russian commentator Fyodor Lukyanov says, that the Chinese are preparing to take a harder line. If the Chinese and the Russians do indeed agree on taking a harder line in relation to Iran, if they do decide to step up their material support for Iran, then I'm going to say straightforwardly that this episode is essentially over. The United States has struggled to prevail against Iran, even whilst Iran gets a limited amount of assistance from Russia. If Iran is able to get a major ramp up of assistance from not just Russia, but China as well, it is no longer realistic to think that the United States is any longer in a position to impose its will upon it. At that point, the United States, once this finally hits home, is going to have to seriously consider negotiations, and these will be negotiations in which the balance of advantage will have tilted decisively to the Iranian side. Just say. So that's what I think. That's where I think we are at the present time. Now, all of this discussion of the Chinese and the Russians brings me back to the most interesting man, perhaps, in global politics at the moment. Certainly, the great power leader who attracts the greatest attention, and that is Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia. Now, I have spoken in several places about Putin's relative lack of visibility over the last few weeks since the Valdai attack that took place at the end of December, an attack which virtually everybody of influence in Moscow believes was an assassination attempt by Ukraine and quite possibly by the United States on Putin himself. Well, I received a very interesting private email from the person who provides me with regular updates about discussions that take place on the message boards of the Russian State Duma. And to repeat again, this information is not classified. The message boards are relatively private, but they don't function at the highest level of classification. So this is, well, secret information, but not very secret. And I have no doubt that Western governments are aware of it. Anyway, it turns out that Vladimir Putin has not been inactive or silent at all. He's never been inactive in terms of domestic policies. He deals regularly with situations in the domestic economy, and he keeps his finger very much on the pulse of what is taking place in the various regions. If you go to the Kremlin's website, you will read the many meetings that Putin has with all the sort of officials whose job it is to work and act in this precise area. But it seems that Putin has also been busy, even more busy on the diplomatic front than we know about. Firstly, it seems that as well as his meeting with Araghchi, he has been meeting regularly with representatives coming to Moscow from Iran and also from China. The level of interaction has been particularly intense over the last few weeks. And according to this source, and by the way, this source has been consistently and extremely reliable. Whenever I have been able to corroborate his information, I have obtained definitive corroboration that it is true. And what he has told me has consistently come to pass. Anyway, according to this source, in terms of Putin's personal interactions with Xi Jinping, it is not the case, as I assumed, that Putin and Xi Jinping speak every day on the phone, or most, or at least once a week on the phone. Rather, given worries about who might be listening in and concern about the enormous reach of US intelligence and of US hacking capabilities, it seems that most of the contacts between Xi Jinping and Putin take place in writing through messages that are exchanged regularly several times a week through special courier. And in fact, it seems that the couriers in question are Chinese and Russian military officers who carry regular messages between Beijing and Moscow in special flights. And there is apparently a Chinese and a Russian officer involved in all of these exchanges. But anyway, all of that is very interesting, but there is perhaps even more interesting information, and this relates to Putin's actual movements, because he has not just been in the Kremlin over the last few weeks, as I believed and as I discussed in my program yesterday. Certainly, he's keeping his movements secret, obviously in part because of worries about potential Ukrainian assassination attempts after Valdai. But at some point over the last few weeks, Putin has made two trips to Rostov-on-Don, the city where the headquarters of the Russian forces who conduct the special military operation are located. And he has also carried out at least one visit to the northern city of Bryansk, where I believe Group of Forces North has, if not its main headquarters, at least a headquarters. And it seems to me very likely that Putin has met with the military there. Gerasimov, I believe, is nowadays mostly headquartered in Rostov-on-Don, and Putin will have received a detailed briefing from him. And since there were two trips to Rostov-on-Don, it is likely that there was first a briefing and then a follow-up briefing. And then there was also a further briefing, which Putin will probably have received in Bryansk, though it seems that there Putin also had meetings with the local civilian officials. Bryansk is a frontier region, but it's also an important location where a significant part of the Russian military industrial complex is located. So there we go. So Putin has been active and he's been meeting privately with his generals. It's not what we saw last year of Putin going to the headquarters, having what were clearly staged briefings for the benefit of the cameras, provided with updates about the military situation and appearing to give orders, but all done mostly with a view to giving us all an insight about the military situation and to project to the Russian people the image of their president firmly in control. This time, it looks as if the briefings, far from being staged, were serious and real, and it's difficult to avoid the impression that they are connected, deeply connected, with the events in the war, the ongoing military operations on the conflict line. Now, along with this report, I've received a further detailed report about Putin's own interactions with the Wagner organization and about the history of relations between the Wagner organization and the military, the Russian military, which is also very interesting, but which, in order not to confuse matters, I will discuss later in a different program. Anyway, in the meantime, as I said, Putin is having all of these meetings, and the Russian Defense Ministry itself has delivered a strong warning to the Ukrainians. And the warning relates to Ukrainian threats to carry out drone attacks against the Victory Day parade in Moscow on the 9th of May. And the Russian Defense Ministry has said that if such a thing happens, the Russian military will conduct a devastating response and they will carry out attacks on Kiev itself, on central Kiev. And in fact, this is the statement that, in accordance with the decision of the Supreme Commander-in-Chief of the Russian Armed Forces, Vladimir Putin, a ceasefire is declared on 8th, 9th May 2026 in honor of the celebration of the victory of the Soviet people in the Great Patriotic War. We expect the Ukrainian side to follow this example. At the same time, we have taken note of the statement made by the head of the Kiev regime in Yerevan at the European Political Community Summit, which contains threats to strike Moscow on 9th May. The head of the Kiev regime is, of course, none other than Vladimir Zelensky himself. And the Russian Defense Ministry statement continues, the armed forces of the Russian Federation will take all necessary steps to ensure the security of the festive events. Should the Kiev regime attempt to carry out criminal plans aimed at disrupting the celebrations of the 81st anniversary of the victory in the Great Patriotic War, the Russian armed forces will launch a retaliatory, massive missile strike on the center of Kiev. Despite the capabilities at its disposal, Russia has previously refrained from such actions for humanitarian reasons. We warn the civilian population of Kiev and the staff of foreign diplomatic missions to leave the city in a timely manner. Now, to my mind, this is clearly a threat to attack central Kiev using Oreshnik missiles. If the Ukrainians conduct drone attacks trying to disrupt the May 9th celebrations, the Russian Defense Ministry has now been given the green light from Vladimir Putin to conduct strikes using Oreshnik missiles on central Kiev, on the famous decision-making centers. And notice that the Russians here are giving a warning to the civilian population and to the diplomatic community in Kiev to leave the city whilst these celebrations, the Victory Day celebrations, are underway and whilst Zelensky's threats remain in effect. There's been much speculation about when the Russian military might conduct its next Oreshnik strike. It carried out its first strike in November 2024 against the Yuzhmash factory in the city of Dnipro. We've heard virtually nothing about that factory ever since, despite the fact that it is, or was, perhaps the single most important industrial plant in the territory of Ukraine and at the forefront of Ukraine's own ballistic missile program. So, despite speculations and attempts by some people to push back against Professor Postol's analysis of that strike, my conclusion has to be that the strike was indeed very successful, or at least very effective. And then we had the equally enigmatic attack that took place a few months ago against the facility close to the city of Lvov. Again, there was much speculation about what that was all about, but the Russians have subsequently confirmed that it was indeed, as I was privately informed, an attack on a training and air facility, a place where drones produced for Ukraine in Europe completed their assembly, and where certain command bunkers operated by European and Western personnel were located. Again, the exact effectiveness of this attack is unclear and has never been disclosed by either party. But Macron, the French president, was clearly upset after this attack took place. Various statements that he made essentially confirmed it, which again leads me to believe that the attack was again extremely effective. This time, the Russians are giving a warning of an attack, a potential attack, unquestionably using the Oreshnik, on the most high profile target in Ukraine, which is the center of Kiev, where Zelensky has his office, where the Ukrainian government and the various other Ukrainian agencies are located, where the diplomatic staff are based. As the Russian Defense Ministry says, up to this time, the Russian Defense Ministry has not carried out an attack on central Kiev of this kind, but now they are prepared to do it, and they have been given permission to do it. Now, for me, the last is interesting because, again, I read reports, and these, by the way, came from more than one source, that the Russian Defense Ministry at one point earlier over the last year was indeed urging Putin to authorize a drone, an Oreshnik strike on central Kiev itself. And Putin categorically said no. He said that the risk of civilian injuries was too high. The risk of damage to historic buildings was too great. In fact, he was, it seems, extremely categorical in refusing to give this permission. Now, apparently, he has. The Russian Defense Ministry has never made a threat of this kind before. It is a new departure. Whether the Ukrainians will heed this threat, or warning if you prefer to call it, we will see. But if they do, this time, I do expect Oreshniks to be launched against Kiev itself. And, well, we will see what the consequences and the effects of that strike, if it happens, are going to be. Now, the Defense Ministry refers to this meeting that has been taking place in Armenia. This is a European meeting which Prime Minister Pashinyan of Armenia is hosting. Pashinyan came to power as a result of what I personally would consider, looking back, definitely a color revolution event, very much as the person who would guide Armenia into the embrace of the West. He's been edging away from Russian institutions, the Collective Security Treaty Organization, the Eurasian Union. He's been inching steadily, not actually that steadily, but he's been moving Armenia steadily towards the West. He sacrificed, I think that's the only correct word, Nagorno-Karabakh along the way. And, well, a few weeks ago, he was in Moscow. He met with Putin there. Putin told him quite straightforwardly that if this trend continues, if Armenia chooses to join the Western institutions, if it starts forging trade agreements with the EU in order undoubtedly eventually to join the EU, then it must understand that it can no longer remain part of the Eurasian Union, and that relationship must end. And Pashinyan refused to accept that. He insisted that it is fine for Armenia to continue to ride both horses at the same time, for it to remain part of the Eurasian Economic Union, in other words, to continue to be tied to Russia, even as it continues to integrate itself more closely economically with the West. Now, I understand that there are elections pending in Armenia in a few months, and I suspect that this big meeting in Yerevan has partly been conducted in order to help Pashinyan win that election. I'm not sure whether it will or whether it won't. I understand that Pashinyan has many critics and opponents in Armenia up to now. But ever since he managed to gain power, and despite the defeat in Nagorno-Karabakh, he has been actually very successful in clinging on. And of course, he has the support of the phalanx of NGOs and other institutions in Armenia, which represent his core constituency. But regardless, he has to take into account one absolutely central fact, which is that Armenia has indeed experienced something of an economic boom over the last few years, something which undoubtedly has played its part in keeping him in control. But this has, to a great extent at least, been based on successful, ongoing economic relations with Russia. If Putin follows through on his ever so gently expressed threat of throwing Ukraine out of the Eurasian Economic Union, then it might be difficult for that boom to continue. And, well, Armenia might find itself in growing economic problems, especially given that its erstwhile allies in the West, the European Union, are about to find themselves in acute economic problems as well. Anyway, I'm not going to dwell on all of this. This is a topic that perhaps will repay further discussion. But since the Russian Defense Ministry mentioned that meeting in Yerevan, I thought I would say something about it. Now, in the meantime, and this is perhaps what all those trips by Putin to Bryansk and Rostov-on-Don were all about, the war in Ukraine continues. And in fact, we're getting now some interesting and dramatic moves. Firstly, in the Sumy region, the Russians about a day ago announced that they'd captured a small town in Sumy region called Miropilia. And its capture apparently brings us closer to a situation where the regional capital, Sumy, becomes encircled. Now, I have found it very difficult to understand exactly what Russian thinking is about these operations in Sumy and Kharkiv and northern Kharkiv region. But anyway, whatever, the Ukrainians seem to be very sensitive about the situation in Miropilia. As soon as the announcement from Moscow came that the Russians have captured Miropilia, the Ukrainians rushed out a denial, insisting that Miropilia continues to be firmly under their control. And then, over the course of the last 24 hours, they published two videos which purports to show Ukrainian troops raising their flags or showing their flags in Miropilia. Unfortunately, these two videos, as far as I can see, far from corroborating the Ukrainian claims, actually undermine them. The videos appear to show two entirely different groups of soldiers. Both videos look very carefully staged, and apparently, so far, it has proved impossible to geolocate either video in Miropolia itself. Now, all of this leads me to think that probably the situation in Sumy region is both more difficult for the Ukrainians than I'd imagined, and more dangerous for the Ukrainians than I had understood. But anyway, there it is. I am not going to explore that further. Elsewhere, the situation for the Ukrainians is verifiably deteriorating. Firstly, the Russians have conducted what appears to be a significant sweep of their forces in northern Donbass, very close to Slavyansk. The Russian overall commander, General Gerasimov, recently claimed that the Russians now control 70% of the contested city of Liman. There's been now video footage which appears to show Russian troops operating to the west of Liman, which suggests that the Ukrainians in Liman are either surrounded or at risk of becoming surrounded. But perhaps more interesting is that the Russians appear to have suddenly seized a very large, significant area of territory, including various villages to the northwest of Liman, near the town of Sviatigorsk, which has, as I've discussed previously, an important monastery, and where there is an important forested area located to the northeast of Slavyansk. Now, this forested area is well known to people who were following the war closely, as I did back in 2022. Because before Ukraine's successful August, September, October Kharkiv counteroffensive, the only successful counteroffensive that the Ukrainians have conducted in this war, by the way, fully successful, the Russians controlled much of this territory, and in particular, they controlled this very same forested area north and northeast of Slavyansk that their forces are now entering. And at that time, the Ukrainians conducted a very successful defense of this forested area. It was heavily fortified and mined, and the Russian soldiers came to refer to it as Sherwood Forest. Well, in those days, it was universally acknowledged that the Ukrainians were the masters of battle in forested country, and that the Russians, who were much more heavily tied to their armoured vehicles, struggled in wooded country. Today, the situation has reversed. Today, it is the Russians who are better, by general acknowledgement, at operating in forested territory. And the point about this forest is that control of it would bring the Russians very close to Slavyansk itself and would cut all of the main roads to Slavyansk from the north, these being in fact the main supply roads to Slavyansk. In my opinion, if the Russians control this forest, do gain control of this forest, which they seem about to gain control of, once Liman falls, we will see, in effect, an encirclement of Slavyansk from the north. And if we go further south, in the area of Konstantinovka, the other end of the Slavyansk Kramatorsk Konstantinovka conurbation, well, there are further confirmation of Russian advances in Konstantinovka. And now, that which I had been talking about for some time, about a encirclement of the Ukrainian garrison in Konstantinovka, that is now becoming a commonplace, as I've noticed, amongst many commentators and people who talk about the situation in the war. Now, Donbass remains the single most important battlefront. It does increasingly look as if we are indeed entering the final stage of the battle for Donbass. The Ukrainian position in Konstantinovka is becoming very precarious. It's perhaps starting to look like the Ukrainian position in Pokrovsk at the beginning of December. The fall of Konstantinovka and these Russian advances in the north, in and around Slavyansk, would bring us very close to the point where we can talk about a cauldron around Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. And there's been further video footage now which confirms or appears to confirm Russian claims about the Russians having gained control of the eastern part of the village of Rai Alexandrovka, located on the hill to the east of Kramatorsk, strategically positioned to interfere with the Ukrainian supply lines to that city. So this is now shaping up as the start of what will be the final battle for Donbass, or, if you prefer, the final stage in the battle of Donbass. The battle which has raged continuously throughout the entire history of the special military operation since roughly May 2022. And this is the most important ground battle of the war. Victory in this battle, in my opinion, is the key for the Russians to unlocking the rest of Ukraine. And that is reason enough, I would have thought, to explain Putin's visits to Rostov-on-Don and to Bryansk and to his discussions with the chiefs of the military there. So we are in an interesting situation where the Russians, whose economy, as I said, appears to be resuming a growth, coming back onto a growth trajectory again, and who have, as they would see it, the Americans bogged down in the Persian Gulf, and who can see that the Europeans are in increasing disarray, are now moving in the Donbass. Well, if you like to use the expression, moving for the kill. And the Europeans are in disarray. There's been a whole su succession of dismayed, shocked statements about the American decision to pull the 5,000 troops out of Europe. In fact, I will say that I am personally surprised at how shocked and dismayed the Europeans say that they are over this decision to withdraw the American decision to withdraw troops. So we've had statements from Kaya Kallas. There has been talk about withdrawing US troops from Europe for a long time, but of course the timing of this announcement comes as a surprise. And then she said, I think it shows that we have to really strengthen the European pillar in NATO and we really have to do more. American troops are not in Europe only for protecting European interests, but also American interests. I don't see into the head of President Trump, so he has to explain it himself. So that was Kaya Kallas. We've had Mark Rutte, the NATO Secretary General, saying that the Europeans have gotten the message. They heard the message loud and clear. Europeans are stepping up, a bigger role for Europe and a stronger NATO. The Norwegian Prime Minister, Jonas Gahr Støre, tried to reassure everybody. I wouldn't exaggerate that because I think we're expecting that Europe is taking more charge of its security. I do not see those figures as dramatic, but I think they should be handled in a harmonious way inside NATO. And anyway, we have all of these comments, even as the Americans are making it increasingly clear how unhappy with the Europeans they are. When European leaders talk in this way, when they try to reassure each other that this isn't such a big deal, really, and when they tell us also about how Europe is going to step up and take over the burden from the Americans of defending itself, well, that is an infallible sign that they are actually really, really worried and that they are very unhappy about the fact that this was not discussed with them by the Americans in advance. Because, of course, they all know deep down that they are not in a position to replace the Americans. There is no European military industrial complex such as the one the United States has. They lack the capabilities to take on the Russians by themselves. As everyone knows, they are in no position themselves to replace the Americans, and despite all the brave talk of European rearmament, which I've discussed in many places, the reality is it is not going to happen, or at least it is not going to happen anytime soon, in any kind of time frame of the sort that we are hearing about. With Europe plunging into deindustrialization and decline, talk about the Europeans replacing the Americans is a fantasy on top of all of the other fantasies we have heard from the Europeans over the last 20, 30 years, which have brought Europe to the disastrous point, the disastrous position, in which, of course, it is in. As the economic crisis deepens, as things in Europe go from bad to worse, and they would have done anyway, by the way, even if the Strait of Hormuz had not been closed, but of course things are going to get much worse now that the Strait of Hormuz is closed. Well, even as things get worse, so the prospects of this rearmament and all of that is going to continue to fade away. Now, my guess is that all of this is going to hit home sometime around the late summer, early autumn. This is about the time when we're going to see, based on previous events, the military crisis in the Donbass, and probably, by the way, in Zaporozhye as well, another topic for discussion on a later day. I wonder what the Europeans are going to say then. There's going to be a crisis moment for NATO. I suspect that that is when it will come. That is when the full gravity of the crisis, military, economic, geostrategic, and political, will fully hit home. Given the kind of European leaders that we have at the moment, it is impossible to predict what they're going to do. But I fully expect it to be driven by panic and extremely hysterical and angry. And of course, it will also be much else too. Well, anyway, we shall see. But this is where I'm going to finish the programme today. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. You can support our work by Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.